Hi, this is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Pop a top again. I've just got time for one more round. Set 'em up, my friend. Then I'll be gone and you can let some other fool sit down.
We'll see if we can get Grant Newsham on. We're a little late. The Skype music. Whoa.
Grant
Newsham, Mike McNamara, good morning to you.
Hi there, how are you?
So, where are you today? Did you make it back safely from Albania or wherever you were?
No, not yet. I'm in Krakow, Poland.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So, do you enjoy that part of the world? What are you doing there? Are you working? Or are you still vacationing and going to weddings and things like that?
Oh, it's more the vacation thing, but I'm actually on my way back to Bangkok, Thailand, for an event, but one of the rare things I get invited to. So I'm just here for a couple days.
All right. Tell us about having never been to Poland. I've only read about it via James Michener. Tell me about Poland. What is to enjoy about Poland?
It's like Europe, Southwestern Europe, but it's really cheap, but it's got, how would you call it? There's something different about Eastern Europe compared to Western Europe. The history is different. You know, they've been invaded from the East and the South forever.
Right.
And the people are different. It's like a Pole's different than, say, an English guy or a Frenchman. The architecture is good. It's surprising. Some of the Krakow didn't get damaged in World War II, so it's got a lot of centuries-old architecture there. The Mongols sacked the place in the 13th century, but they've recovered pretty well since then. And it's really cheap. You know, Eastern Europe is one of the hidden secrets if you're a tourist. Imagine, say, going to London or Paris and walking down the street, and everything costs about half as much, if that. So Eastern Europe and Slovakia, it's even cheaper. So it's got a lot of history. There's castles all over the place. And if you like old buildings and just that old European atmosphere, it's highly recommended.
All right. Nikki Haley stepping down at the UN. I think the news rocked the United States this morning. Because she has been such, at least in my opinion, she's done such a great job of representing the United States for the last couple of years. The president just spoke from the White House along with Ambassador Haley, and she just said, look, I'm governor of South Carolina for 6 years. I've done this for two in addition to campaigning for the president. You need to know when to go, and it's time for me to go. And she said, and I won't be running for president in 2020. I'll be supporting the president. So they were holding a media event. Your thoughts on Nikki Haley leaving and the job she's done?
That's too bad. I think she's the best ambassador to the UN the Americans have had since Jean Kirkpatrick during the Reagan era, and before that since Daniel Patrick Moynihan. It's rare that, say, a cabinet official or an official from the government doesn't leave and you don't forget about them within a week. But she's one that will be missed. I thought she did just an excellent job defending U.S. interests, principles. She had a manner that was perfect for that job. And she spoke up effectively and took on the evil, for what want of a better word, and did it very well.
Well, that's a George Bush term. Be careful.
Okay, well, she took on nasty people, of the Mongol sorts who sacked Krakow in the 13th century. But she's a rare, sort of a rare character, and be very hard to replace. Have they said who's coming next?
No. They're just, she won't, she'll stay in her position until the end of the year. So no other announcement other than them talking about what's gone on, the issues that she's dealt with since she's been there, and as you said, taking on everybody. And she, but I will say this, she had a way about her, for whatever reason, her ability to speak, and especially when staring down the likes of whether it be Russia, whether it be Syria and the chemical weapons involved there, whether it be China or whoever. Nikki Haley had a way about her when she got animated. I mean, she did not lose. It's almost like she got better when she got animated, if that makes sense. Some people can't do that. She had a way about her of staying perfectly on point, yet, you know, showing, I guess, the fire that she has for the cause of the United States. And that came through. I guess it played very well on television. And she's very, very interesting woman. And as you said, she'll be incredibly missed, I think, by the administration.
She said, you know, she had a manner about her, both sort of, I don't know, physically, appearance-wise, and the way she spoke, that not everyone has. You know, you could have had somebody who, you know, in that position, who may have said the exact same things, but it wouldn't have worked. I think we've seen that, you know, with military officers. There's some guys who just have that manner, got that magic, and you can't duplicate it, you can't imitate it, but she had it. As I saw it, and you know, as I say, I hope there's somebody like her lurking take the position.
No, you know, it just goes to the credibility. You know, I struggle with the president, like I think most people do, and his manner sometimes. But one of the things I do think that the president has done right. I don't believe you'll find a better Secretary of Defense than the one that currently sits in there. I think Mike Pompeo is spot on in terms of the job that he's doing. And I think when you get those ones right, the rest of them tend to fall in place. And so I think that our policies in terms of a country are where they should be. I think in terms of economic confrontation, a little bit with Canada, a little bit with Mexico. I think that stuff has been long overdue. I think the economic confrontation with China is long overdue. And I quote you often as saying, you know, the United States is standing up on its hind legs and people are taking notice, which I find kind of an amusing statement. But I think nonetheless it's true, and she's been a part of that. And so I think the president, as much as, you know, sometimes his manner and style give me pause to close my eyes and tightly, I think he's got the people around him and the policy pieces. For the most part, I think he's been right, and she's been a big part of that. So it'll be interesting. I sent you an article over the weekend written by a guy named Stephen Mosier. Do you know of Stephen Mosier? Have you met him? Do you know him?
No, I just know of him. That's all.
All right. I only have read a little bit of what he's written. A Chinese studier and writer since the 1970s, was allowed into China to do research, was forced to leave Stanford in much the same way as a dissident recently was forced to leave NYU when China contacted Stanford and said, we don't want him. If you're going to do business here in China, you need to make him go away. And they did. Do you have any thoughts on him? Is he as a writer, as an intellectual, any thoughts on him?
Oh, I, you know, would probably be presumptuous to sort of have too much of an opinion, but I think he's pretty good. I would submit that, you know, if you were to take the pantheon of China experts, and you look at, say, go back 30 years, and look at how many of them, and the most prominent ones, have been completely wrong about the PRC,
right,
in terms of what the PRC would become, how it would develop, really in terms of becoming a nicer country. they've all been wrong. And also in terms of the policies which they not only recommended to the U.S. successive U.S. administrations, but that were implemented, they were wrong. And how this is almost half a century of being as wrong as you can possibly be and putting the country at great risk. Now, Stephen Mosher's in this other group of people who sized things up more quickly or a long time ago and really were and were right all along and were not listened to. One might, they may debate some of the specifics of things he says, but
right.
my reading of him is that, he's one of these guys that was not part of the groupthink, wasn't part of the in crowd. And these guys were ignored, ostracized, ridiculed, and I mean all of those, for decades. And he's just one of them. It's a fairly small group, but it's really got some impressive people in it. That's how we'll call it what you want, the swamp or this group of people who've been wrong, have acted for these decades. Anyone who just didn't agree with them was belittled, humiliated, and ignored and sidelined. And very rarely would an administration even talk to these people. Yet, had any of them been listened to and been followed, we wouldn't be in the fix we're in. So that's where I would say that he falls in, and that's, I think, something certainly to his considerable credit.
Why do we continue to want to believe that totalitarian nations can be, if we just talk a little bit nicer, maybe speak a little bit slower, explain that to me. Because in my mind, I see the reset button, with the Russians, well, if we talk slower and we just don't come across as belligerent, then we can do business with them. The Chinese, even to the dumbest, of politicians or, and I use the word statesmen in quotes, a $350 billion deficit with anybody ought to have you looking at that saying, that probably isn't good. Why does that exist and what are we going to do about it? Yet it seems like we don't really want to go there. What is it about our foreign policy that we think we can change a totalitarian regime's stances by being nicer or looking the other way? What is that?
Well, boy,
that's a deep philosophical question for you, Nusha.
Yeah, I suspect it's been that thinking has been around probably since caveman days. It might even manifest itself in one's desire not to go to the dentist, instead just take an aspirin or something. But it's putting off something that's difficult, I think, is part of the equation, just in exchange for a temporary reprieve, almost, and hope that things get better. Maybe it's human nature not to want to fight or want to have conflict. In this idea that anything's better than that, and that somehow the other guy will, somehow he'll just, he'll figure it out and he'll turn out to be a really nice guy. And I do think there is an aspect of human nature that is to explain for this, for that kind of thinking. And I would imagine, I mentioned the Mongols earlier, that you had guys back then who, there must have been a faction in, say, Hungary, Poland, and Russia, who thought, well, we can talk it out with the Khan, with the Mongols. Maybe not as big a faction as you would find today in Washington. But nonetheless, I suspect that there's an aspect of human nature. And then you get, you get the, what I call it, academia, or just this academic thinking that goes to work. And it's a very neat sort of theory that if you understand the other guy's fears, understand why he acts the way he does, and then accommodate those, that he will then see that there's no threat and he will sort of adjust his behavior the way you want and for the better. It's very neat theory, and it, in fact, appeasement theory was once considered what the smart people all thought. And like a lot of academic theories, that, you know, you can put it forth, and if you don't have to live with the results, and somebody else pays on the butcher's bill, you know, they do tend to push these theories that a lot harder than one would like. You see it in the business world as well, if you remember so-called subprime loans, derivatives, credit swap, whatever.
Right.
All of these things that were very, you know, there was a logic, or sort of a logic behind all these that somebody could very persuasively present to gullible people. And I think that there's something similar going on when it comes to these sort of aggressive regimes that want our stuff. You know, they want us and they want our stuff. And that people who, you will have charlatans who think they've got it all figured out, and because they're pedigreed elite very often, or in positions of power, that they even tend to believe it's true, and that other people must believe them. So, you know, this is all nothing new, but it I think a lot of it does go to human nature, one's position, power, and not being really not being exposed to the results of, or the outcomes of, you know, if your mistakes, if your theories are wrong. So, but a lot of it, if you read these old Bible stories about tribes fighting over grazing land, I think this is in some ways just an extrapolation from that kind of thinking. Now, there's one, they did fight it out, but there's a well-known case where one guy says, okay, you have this and I'll go away. And that, you know, created some sort of harmony for a while. But once again, look at human nature, and I think it explains a lot of things.
You know, I'm looking at a story. Here's a headline from today's Early Bird. Google drops out of Pentagon's $10 billion cloud competition. Subheadline one, company says cloud deal may clash with its values on AI. Google also criticizes plan to pick a single winner among bids. Google values. But Google's values will allow it to assist China in creating its own tools. And I would, you must run into this all the time, this intellectual, let me get the X-Acto knife out and slice this thing and then hide it behind a bunch of gobbledygook. I was going to say bullshit, but I said no, gobbledygook, because I'm talking about intellects. And you must see this all the time, Grant, in terms of, you know, trying to fashion real foreign policy that you know, allows democracy to flourish, allows trade to flourish, yet doesn't undermine, you know, that you're not looking to undermine another foreign system. If you have to bump into them, then you bump into them. But then you see this kind of stuff. And it reminds me of the saying, don't piss down my back and tell me it's raining. So you won't help the United States, and you won't participate with the American Pentagon, but you will participate, you know, in with the totalitarian regime in what essentially amounts to creating tools to help it subjugate its population better. And, oh, by the way, you know, probably will translate to tracking. If you clicked on this website, all of a sudden you're going to get this. Oh, Dad, it's for you. It's the police. Somebody was browsing on the computer and went to this website. Yeah, that's my dad. He's interested in that. You're going to get that knock on the door. Does it get nauseating in the world of foreign policy when you get the, you know, the Thurston Howell III's that stand up and try to run their gobbledygook past you?
Especially when there's empirical evidence that these people are wrong and that their ideas are failing and have been failing for decades. Then it is irksome. You know, what do you do? I mentioned these people who've been ostracized, and I don't consider myself in that category because I've never been of any prominence.
So in order to be ostracized, you have to be prominent.
Yeah, you got to at least be in the ballpark. But I do know people who really are outstanding, and, you know, have been treated this way. And now that is bothersome, both, you know, in a personal sense for them, but also for the what the damage it's done to our country. You know, the, and you look at, you know, this sort of thing, the Korean War, World War II, all these things that could have been prevented with some clearer thinking, and we're not. And, you know, that is bothersome, worrisome even today. And yet you notice once each of these disasters happen, we'll say, just take World War II and Korea, it's not like the people who created that, those situations, that any of them suffered for that, either professionally or in any other way. And they certainly, none of them got killed, because those people are always way far away from the front lines, if they even serve.
Right.
But so none of them ever pay for the mistakes. And I think that's one of the things that really gets you. It's sort of, well, never mind, you know, and they just keep going from strength to strength. With the Google thing, you know, one thing I've noticed, you know, over the years is that you often find people of, you know, often very well-paid people who have some particular technical expertise or financial expertise, but they're incredibly ill-informed about other things, particularly what I've described as how the world works, or even how other people get along in life. It is this, and they're not even curious about it, but it's this, some particular expertise in a certain area is considered to make somebody an expert on all sorts of things, when in fact they're not. These are very, I'd say, really poorly educated people, except in a specific field. And that, I think, is what you're seeing at Google. I would imagine that if you gave any of these people a multiple choice history test, or foreign affairs test, that, or even a what goes on in Indiana test, I don't think any of them would pass it. I think they would fail miserably. So it is this lack of familiarity with history, with, say, as I said, how the world works, that I think leads to this sort of Google-esque kind of behavior. And I think they generally just, these are just some pretty dumb people who don't understand the difference between a consensual government, a consensual society like ours that respects individual liberty, and one like the CC, the Chinese Communist Party, has running. It is about that bad. You know, I think if you ask them to explain the difference between the two systems, I don't think they could. I think they would probably come out and describe the United States as the worst of the two systems. So it really is a very sort of well-paid, well-dressed, well-pedigreed stupidity. And there's a maliciousness to it, I would consider as well, but particularly when it comes into this, well, we know better than everyone else. We're better than these people, you know, who fight wars, who do bad things. You know, because
we invented a search engine.
Kind of, yeah. Right. You know, what is it? Be as if the guy, say, 80 years ago, if the guy who knew how to repair a carburetor or a fuel pump in an old model, whatever, car, if he was considered to have this great, to be this great source of wisdom on all things about the world. And these are just, you know, a version of the guy who, the guy who was a carburetor repairman for Henry Ford back in the 1920s, but nobody thought they could do anything more than repair carburetors, which was a nice thing. And then you go back beyond that, it was probably the guy who could fix the grindstone at a mill. He was considered a genius. Well, they weren't. Nobody attributed that much power and wisdom to them. But here, because somebody can do IT, they're considered geniuses on anything and everything outside of that narrow field. And instead of being looked at really as tradesmen, rather than masters of the universe. And the same goes with the financial world as well, and it's as bad there on Wall Street as you'll find in Silicon Valley. That's just my take on it.
No, is there anything different between, and I think I've asked you this before, but between, you know, our mercenary companies that plundered Latin America for fruit, Continental Fruit Company, what was it, United, No, Continental Can Company and then United Fruit going down there and then asking the United States, hey, you need to come down here and protect us. But they're essentially plundering Latin America for their own profit. And there is no other metric in terms of, or is what we're doing, is there any other relative good to it? It's simply, you know, where the money is to be made. And for Google, this company that stresses their own values, how do you get in bed with a totalitarian regime? But again, we've got to get the X-Acto knife and find a way, because do you know how much money is to be made when you have that many billion people there to look at your product and advertise to them? That's a lot of money. So I don't know. It just strikes me as odd. I want to ask you. I want to talk about your comment about Taiwan. You wrote about Taiwan. I want to talk about that. I want to talk about North Korea, and I want to talk about China. Talk to me about China. Stephen Mosier contends that Trump has already won with China. Now what is the only thing that is left is cutting the deal with them. Your take on that?
That I'm not as confident as he is. I think it's not going to be that easy. I mean, that's where I took some issue with his position, which you've laid out very well. But Mr. Trump is certainly in a fairly good position, but it needs to be played out over the long term, and it's not something that's going to be resolved anytime soon, you know, at least not resolved properly, because you do have this fundamental difference in the way these societies and governments are run. And it's not going to be resolved by China agreeing to do certain things business-wise or economically. What I would note is all the things that China's been asked to do are things that they have already promised that they would do when they joined the World Trade Organization a while back, and they haven't done any of those. So why is it that they're suddenly going to transform their entire sort of reason for existence, you know, the way that they just do things? Why is it that they're going to come to Washington or wherever and say, okay, we've changed? And one of the best ways descriptions I've heard from a guy, I won't say who it was, but he knows his stuff, about why China behaves the way it does, or the way that the Chinese Communist Party behaves the way it does. And that's always important to make that distinction. He describes it, he used crass terms, but well, think of how a dog licks himself. He just does it. You know, that is a way to, so it's kind of hard, even if he didn't want to, he'd just sort of instinctively, well, lick himself. And so it's not easy to change this. So that's where I would say that the argument that, well, Mr. Trump has won, and it's just a question of when China decides to give up, I'm not quite that optimistic. I think it will take a lot more pressure. And ultimately, I don't know if it's possible to really come to a favorable resolution with the Chinese Communist Party in power. I'm sort of starting to think that we may just end up with something like an old Cold War, with these two systems and sort of jostling or fighting it out to see which one's better or which one's going to win. And that requires the United States to have a clear sense of what it wants and a willingness to stick to the sort of a strict approach and to this and not think that a promise by the Chinese Communist Party that it will reform its behavior is going to lead to any real reform. So I'm not quite in agreement with Mr. Mosher on this particular point, though I think he is right that the U.S. has gone from having in poker terms, having like a pair of twos to at least having a pair of aces if it plays it right.
Interesting. All right. I found the article interesting, and for those of you who haven't read the article that I'm talking about, you can find it on the Read Board. If you just go to the All Marine Radio website and go to the Read Board, you will find it there. Next question. Taiwan. Where does Taiwan fit in all of this? you know, those of us who remember history a little bit, you know, two Chinas, one China, does China belong to, does Taiwan belong to China because it says it does? And China is now merely a chip in the extortion that is committed by the Chinese government as they hold out their demand for any product that you as a nation may sell. We can make you prosperous. We can raise all your boats. Chinese demand is insatiable. We need what you sell. But you need to cut off all relations with China, with Taiwan. Tell us about Taiwan. How does Taiwan exist? Where does it fit in the world? Make us smart about Taiwan.
Oh, boy. Taiwan is important. I think everybody knows Taiwan. It's always worth looking at a map because geography will tell you a lot about Taiwan's importance. If Taiwan, say, floated off to where, Cape Verde Islands are, off of Africa, nobody would really mind much. But it is key terrain geographically. It is right in the middle of the so-called first island chain, going from basically Japan down to Borneo, and it's right in the middle of it. And the and on those grounds alone, it is key. If a country, say China, gets control of Taiwan or access to it, it suddenly has access, full, free, easy access out into the Pacific Ocean and beyond. Almost the equivalent, say, of the walls of Constantinople being breached in 1493 or whatever it was. Once the walls were breached, it got really hard to defend against the Turks. And this would undercut really a defense line, an American, Japanese sort of free world, free country defense line that really keeps, that sort of prevents an aggressive sort of fascist China from really throwing its weight around. So geography is important. It's always worth looking at a map to see where Taiwan is located, particularly relevant to the Philippines, to Japan, and the South China Sea sea lanes. It's a perfect location for doing a lot of things militarily. Now, you often hear, though, that there's this a one China policy.
Yes.
And you hear that thrown out a lot, and China uses it to mean, China claims that Taiwan is part of China, even though it's never really been part of China except for a little while, a couple hundred years ago, just very loosely held, and that was actually by a dynasty run by Mongolia, or run by foreigners, not by Han Chinese. But China claims Taiwan belongs to the PRC. And they say that that is what the one China policy means. Meanwhile, China, although Taiwan no longer says this, it used to say that Taiwan was in fact the legitimate government of all of China.
Right.
And the American position, which is the so-called one China policy, is to recognize that PRC has its opinion, Taiwan has its opinion, and the Americans have no Americans have no position either way other than to agree that, yes, there is one China. The matter remains to be resolved, but it must be resolved peacefully because one, we want it to be done peacefully, but also Taiwan is America's ally. It's America's friend, and it's therefore it needs to be done without violence. But that is what one China policy means. It does not mean, as the Chinese say, that the Americans have agreed with the Chinese position that Taiwan, yes, is part of, is really part of the PRC. And it does not mean that. But successive U.S. administrations have not articulated this well at all. So most people don't understand what one China policy actually means. Now, it's important to remember that Taiwan, for many years, when it was run by Chiang Kai-shek and his successors, was actually kind of a repressive place, although it was better than the PRC. Mm. And however, about 20-plus years ago, Taiwan moved to a consensual democracy, a government where they have elections, they have a free press, a very critical press, they have public debates. It's a pretty free economically. It's very free. You can actually have a contract enforced there. So Taiwan is actually, has developed quite nicely as a democracy, as a consensual government, which is sort of an embarrassment to the Chinese Communist Party-led PRC, which claims that Chinese people can only be governed with repression and ruthlessness. They can't handle anything else. But Taiwan demonstrates quite the opposite. If you go to both places, you'll be surprised. It's almost like two completely different universes, where the PRC is kind of a grim place, where there's a sort of a foreboding or threat around, and it's really haphazard and just wild. And go to Taiwan, it's full of friendly people. It's a bright, lively place. And you can kind of get whatever you want and do whatever you want, and the police are not going to show up at your door if you say that the president of Taiwan looks like Winnie the Pooh. Very different places. In fact, I would suggest Taiwan is a better example of what China should be, or it's an excellent example of the real China, as opposed to what the PRC, the Chinese Communist Party, has done to mainland China. So Taiwan, very important militarily in terms of geopolitics, and also it's an existential threat to the Chinese Communist Party by virtue of demonstrating that Taiwanese can handle a consensual government and freedom, but it's only got about 25 million people compared to, say, 1.3 or 4 billion mainland Chinese, and it's in a very difficult spot. The Chinese government is isolating it politically. It's implied economic pressure on it, and it's this constant harassment and intimidation that does wear down the people in Taiwan. And the Chinese Communist Party would prefer to have Taiwan just give up, in sort of the way Hong Kong has kind of been absorbed into China. As opposed to invading Taiwan, but they're ready to do an invasion if they need to. So that's a pretty long explanation, but maybe it had something of use in there.
No, it does. So how does the Trump administration see Taiwan? And so I think I had General Tulin on, and he said, well, look, if you look at what we've done to China militarily, we have them hemmed in. He said, if you go from the Korean Peninsula through Japan, through Taiwan, the Philippines, even Southeast Asia, which is turning against the Chinese, and then down to Australia, he said, you can see, look at a map. That's problematic for them. And you talked about penetrating the first island line, and China's perspective of breaking those land masses that contain it. How do we now see Taiwan? And you know, we just discussed and I think we just closed a defense deal for, what was it, the F-35 or something that we're going to sell them. So talk about how does Taiwan fit with us militarily?
Until recently, successive U.S. administrations have tried to do as little as possible to support Taiwan, hoping to sort of keep it on life support, give it just enough oxygen to survive.
Barely, though. Which is essentially bowing to the Chinese demand their extortion.
Well, that's exactly right. The idea was, well, we'll just, you know, honor our obligation to Taiwan, which is in writing, but just enough so it doesn't get the Chinese too mad. Because we want all the business with the PRC. We don't want to get them angry. They're a really big country, and, you know, who knows what they would do. And it was sort of buying, playing for time, really hoping that Taiwan would just disappear. It is about that crass and that heartless in certain quarters. But that's what successive administrations have done. Instead of encouraging and helping Taiwan sort of solidify its position, make itself stronger militarily and economically, they have done the bare minimum, hoping that they could have our cake and eat it too, and you know, get all this business in the China market, etc., by not provoking China by being too nice to these free people on Taiwan. So we've wasted a number of years, and the Bush administrations were as bad as anyone on this. So I want to make clear it's been a bipartisan effort. Now, it's only recently that the Americans have really, I say recently, like the last 2 years, that America has had some people who've gotten in the Trump administration who actually support Taiwan have been trying to help it break out of this isolation and tried to give it a little more military support, and even better, to start having some real interchange between U.S. senior U.S. officials in Taiwan, stop this crazy diplomatic isolation that's been ongoing, but to actually make it clear that Taiwan is a friend, an ally, and that we'll support it. But it's really late in the day. It's not to say it's too late, but we've wasted wasted too much time. It remains to be seen, just how serious America is. I think if we ever see a U.S. Navy ship pull into a port in Taiwan for R&R, say if they could have done it when the WASP was refused entry to Hong Kong for Liberty, sent them down to Kaohsiung.
Recently.
When you see that happen, or you see Taiwan units come to America to train on a large scale. In fact, a Taiwan Marine platoon or so actually has come to Hawaii to do training with the Marines at Kaneohe Bay. In the last couple of years, I think it's happened twice. And this is once, at least once, but maybe twice. And this is a big deal if we make something of it. And the America needs to give much more political support, vocal political support for Taiwan, and get it into international forums. China's doing everything it can to keep it out and harass it. And that's one way Nikki Haley was so valuable at the UN. Boy, if she had ever turned her sights on Taiwan and supporting it, it would have been very powerful. But it's really a question of supporting, deciding that we actually value a free people, a free Chinese people, and are willing to do what's necessary to support them and make it clear to the PRC that if they do something to Taiwan, we'll do even worse to them.
But that position comes at a cost, yes? And we have not, again, this whole thing that China has going, to me, it's the same song and dance in all these different venues. Well, if you want to play with us as an emerging nation, have access to our markets, you're not going to go there. And rather than saying, you know what, we are going to go there, and if you want to have access to our markets, which you'll desperately need, which it seems like the president is beginning to do now, then this is the middle ground that we will reach with you. We've never even seemed to have gone there, even when, let's just say 15 years ago, when China wasn't close to what it is today. We didn't go there with China. Why are we so afraid?
Well, I think it comes down to we want to sell one of something to every Chinese person on the mainland. And then there's combined with that this idea that, well, anything's better than the potential of going to war or fighting. And though if the more willing you are to go to war, the less likely you are in this case. But it has been wishful thinking. It was thought that, well, it wasn't all that big a deal because China didn't pose much or that much of a threat. They could never invade Taiwan. They weren't the economic powerhouse they are today. So instead of sort of doing what was wise then to prepare for the future, we just ignored it and allowed the balance to really shift where it's entirely in the PRC's favor. right now. And to change this is going to take an awful lot of hard work. But sometimes it does just take waking up and saying, okay, we're gonna support these people. And that tends to, once you make that decision, a lot of other things happen more easily. But it really is late in the day. And part of the equation here is that you'll often sometimes hear, and you've heard it in the American shattering class, the foreign policy class, well, we shouldn't fight. And you hear in the military, too, actually. But we don't want to, shouldn't fight for the Taiwanese any, because they don't want to fight for themselves. In Taiwan, you will hear, well, yeah, we would do more for ourselves militarily. We would increase defense spending, etc. But we're not sure the Americans will defend us. And it's kind of a chicken and the egg sort of argument. But I think the Americans should break that cycle and be the ones who say, yeah, we're committed. And then you would find that has a bracing effect on Taiwan writ large. But it is that you hear that argument a lot, but it needs to be addressed, and hopefully we will. There are some good people who recognize Taiwan and its existential importance within the Trump administration.
Current population of Taiwan is?
25, 28 million-ish, somewhere in that.
Got it. All right. Next question. Mike Pompeo just left North Korea after another engagement. Your thoughts on that? Maybe another summit in the offing. He says he sounded rather positive, cautiously positive after his last visit. Your thoughts on that?
Of course, Secretary Pompeo is he's the one who has all the information.
Right.
He's the one in the room. So he's in a better position to make a decision. But I would still like to see some concrete concession on North Korea's part. Now, I say I just haven't seen that. Maybe it's coming, but I get the impression that that we're really in the early stages of North Korea offering up something useful. And that shows that they have changed their attitude, changed their positions, and they are willing to reform in a way that we would consider reform useful. But I just get the impression that the optimism may be based partly on the willingness to have another meeting with Mr. Trump. And they're showing some sort of flexibility in that area. But I just don't get the impression that that anything concrete has come about or is coming about, say, that would suggest North Korea sort of wants to become a civilized nation. But that's just my impression. This does bring to mind, if you remember it, all of these the shuttle diplomacy and the visits to the Middle East by any number of secretaries of state who each came back with some sort of vague hint that real progress is being made. And, I can remember those going back to the 1970s. So that's, and yet no real progress has been made, or on a lot of issues in the Middle East. So I'm not too optimistic about the North Korea situation just yet. The Russians and the Chinese still have plenty of opportunity to cause mischief, even if the North Koreans might be inclined to change. And the South Koreans appear keen on giving as much as they possibly can to North Korea to get better behavior. And also there's a sort of an undercurrent or tone in what South Korean says that it suggests the Americans are the problem. If the Americans would just make a sign of show of good faith, just make a concession just this one time, or that will help things along. And if America doesn't, well, it's America's fault. We're in this mess. So that's just kind of just my sense of things, and I think we could have this conversation, a few months from now, probably have a similar assessment. Although, who knows, once Mr. Trump and Kim do meet somewhere, and it doesn't look like that may be coming. You know, who knows, you know, what will come. This one difference about these, the current round of engagement with the North, is that it's the top leaders who seem to have most, who are playing a pretty substantial roles, Kim, Trump, Moon. And in the past, it's always been these lower level functionaries who meet and have grim faces, and then they'll come up with some deal, and then the top leaders will then look at it, and the North will undercut it, of course. But here you have the top guys seem more directly involved than has ever been the case in the past that I'm aware of. And maybe that's something different enough to make one think that maybe something different will turn out this time. You know, who knows?
All right, final question. What are you writing about this week? And, you know, here's an email. Mac, he's in Poland. He sounds like he's next door to you. How are you doing this? This is on Skype. This is the power of Skype, quality audio delivered around the globe. So so well done to the Skype people. So there you have it.
Given that, they are, what's next? I haven't decided. I think something about maybe Toyota deciding that it's going to give away some of its hybrid vehicle technology to China in hopes of really being welcomed into the market better than they have to date. This is just one of these examples of sort of human stupidity, really never going away.
Does it ever end?
No, probably not. And this is Toyota, but maybe that may be the next thing. Maybe something about what the U.S. can do to push China out or back in the South Pacific or in the Pacific Islands. I wrote earlier about what China had done, and now next it would be right about what America should do. So maybe those two topics.
It just doesn't seem to ever even slow down. It's you're going to play by these rules of extortion, or we don't do business. And it just, I don't know, it just seems ridiculous. One more quick question, if you will. The Philippines has seemed to move beyond or kind of backed away from their romance with China. Is that me, or is that in fact the case?
I think they pulled back slightly, is how I would look at it. I think Duterte is still on the Chinese payroll. But you will notice that, you know, this exercise Kuomintang, the old FIBLEX exercise that the Americans have held just this week or last week in the Philippines, and the Japanese participated too, that you see that these kind of exercises still go on. That military relationship continues. And there is a degree of pushback against Duterte, and his popularity has gone down considerably, although it's still pretty high. So the game isn't over when it comes to China trying to subvert the Philippines. And the pendulum has swung back a bit, but it hasn't swung back as far as one would like.
Got it.
Is my sense of it.
Okay. And one other development. The Koreans refused to participate in a naval exercise because the Chinese Navy was flying the Rising Sun. Do we ever get over that?
It was actually the Japanese Navy.
I'm sorry.
Just misspoke, of course, but everybody knew. But I don't think have the Irish ever grown up? when it comes to the English, I don't think the Koreans will ever grow up. They just like to wallow in this sort of resentment and misery, even though they have been just as beastly towards helpless people as the Japanese ever were. I don't think they'll ever change. This is outrageous what they've done to the Japanese, and the Americans should have pulled out of the event as well. But to the Japanese credit, they have allowed a few Korean Navy ships, however, to come to Sasebo shortly on sort of a training mission with a lot of cadets aboard. But Japan is pretty adult about all of this. Unfortunately, they have not backed down. They just pulled out of the event. The Koreans, you know, at a certain time of day, one is inclined to just pull the plug on them and tell them, "Man, we love you guys, but you're on your own. You can go take on North Korea and China yourself." They just refuse to cooperate. And, you know, once again, think of a dog licking himself. He just does it. And it can be, that is something that is irritating at a certain time of day.
All right. Grant, tell everybody where they find your work.
Where they find what?
Your work, the things that you write.
Oh, goodness. I write a lot for Asia Times, something called also Japan Forward, which is part of Japan's Sankei Shimbun. National Interest. I've had a few things there lately. Those are a few places that more often than not you'll find me. Asia Times, Japan Forward, National Interest.
There you have it. Grant Newsham, live from Poland, the first time we've ever done anything from Poland. So, Grant, thanks as always. Thanks for your time.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Okay, always glad to. Mm-hmm.
There you have it. There you have it. The one and only Grant Newsham. We'll take a break. Gunnar joins us next here on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio. Nikki Haley has resigned, in case you haven't heard that news. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on All Marine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it. The McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on All Marine Radio, on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the Read Board page at allmarineradio.com.
To be fully fit, you have to be physically fit. You also have to be mentally fit.
I wish that more warriors would realize how important it is that you get the psychological support that you need so that you can focus on the rest of your life.
I think it takes strength in order to admit that you have an issue, but it also takes intuitiveness of a friend.